This lecture, entitled Water, the Spiritual and Physical Source of Life, is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmas, Yaakov ben Elio, Olav HaShalom, Mr. Jack Tawil, of blessed memory. Can you imagine a world without water, without rain, snow, rivers, or oceans? It would be a world without forests or grasslands, without people, without any life whatsoever. Besides for oxygen, no other entity is as ubiquitous or essential for life as water. It is the most common compound in the Earth's crust, 6 times more abundant than feldspar, the most common mineral on Earth. According to estimates, this world contains some 326 million cubic miles of water. That is a cube of water whose each side is approximately 688 miles. Most of it, a little over 97%, is in the oceans, which cover some 71% of the Earth's surface. To give you a better understanding of these numbers, if the world would be a smooth sphere, and all of the waters of the oceans would be distributed evenly across its surface, the world would be covered in water by a depth of some 8,800 feet. Approximately 1.8% is locked up in glaciers and the polar ice caps. Only some 0.02% of the total water on Earth is actually in our freshwater lakes and rivers. 0.9% of our total water is actually below the surface in aquifers, leaving only 0.001% of the total in the air, the form of vapor, clouds, and precipitation. Just to give you an idea of how little that is, according to estimates of all of the vapor contained in the atmosphere were to condense at once and fall as rain, it would flood the surface of the planet with only about 1 inch of water. The ramifications of that fact and understanding of the Mabul, Noach's flood, will be discussed in the future lecture. But the beauty and life-giving quality of water is that it, like the blood that runs through our arteries and veins, is throbbing with activity. Every day, 210 cubic miles of water evaporate into the atmosphere from the oceans, and another 38 cubic miles from the lakes and rivers and plants. An equal amount condenses and falls back to Earth as rain or snow or dew. It is estimated that on average it takes a molecule of water 9 days in the air before it condenses and comes back to Earth. If it falls into a river, typically a typical river is estimated to flow at a speed about 3 feet per second or some 2 miles an hour, so on average, it stays there for about 2 weeks before evaporating again. If it falls on land, it is soaked into the first few feet of the ground, it can stay there for as little as 2 weeks or as long as a year before it evaporates or is absorbed by plants, eventually to return to the air through a process called transpiration. Like living fountains, plants absorb water from the earth and spray it out as vapor. To give you a feel for the amount of water of which we're speaking, it is estimated that a large oak tree can transpire 40,000 gallons of water in a year into the air. An acre of corn, 3,000 to 4,000 gallons every day. According to some calculations, more water flows through plants during any period of time than flows through all the rivers of the world. Worldwide, nearly 70% of all water used by man goes to irrigating crops. I don't know if you noticed, there was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal recently about the question of allocating more of our resources to biological sources for energy. And it says that the amount of water that it would take to do so would be beyond our capacity. If the water infiltrates into a shallow aquifer or groundwater supply, it may stay there for tens or perhaps hundreds of years. If it penetrates even further down to a deep aquifer, it may not surface for thousands of years. If it falls into a large lake, like Huron, for instance, it may take 10 years for it to re-evaporate. In the ocean depths, perhaps 3,000 years. But eventually, all the water contained within the earth will evaporate and return either as dew, hail, snow, or rain. It's always moving. This whole process of renewal, evaporation, and precipitation is known as the hydrological cycle. Imagine if all the water that is constantly being evaporated would remain suspended, and instead of returning back to Earth, it would remain suspended in the upper atmosphere or escaped outer space. It's estimated that at current rates, even the oceans would completely dry out in just 4,000 years. Our rivers, streams, and aquifers probably within a lifetime or less. So it's a good thing it comes down. But not only is water the most common compound on the planet Earth, it is also the most common compound in the human body. At birth, we are estimated to be made up of some 90% water. At maturity, our bodies are about 70% water. With our blood, some 83% water. For a total volume, about 10 gallons or about 100 pounds. It percolates and diffuses throughout our body, which uses it again and again through 60,000 miles of arteries, veins, and capillaries, pushing our entire body volume through our kidneys, from my sources, every 3 or 3.5 minutes, which cleanses something like 400 gallons a day, flushing out waste and excess salt in the approximately 3 or 4 pints we lose each day in urine. Another pint of moisture is lost through the 30,000 lungfuls of air which we exhale every day. An additional pint of water seeps out of our body in the form of perspiration or tears, which are constantly bathing our eyes. Understandably, then, we have to replenish these 5 or 6 pints that we lose. We can live a few weeks without food. An Indian fakir once did so under observation for 81 days. But without water, assuming normative activity and heat, we can generally only live for 3 or 4 days. A drop of 2% of our body fluid immediately manifests itself in thirst or pain. A 5% loss induces hallucinations, and a loss of 12% is lethal. Drinking water, milk, or juice satisfies about half of our needs. Another 15% is produced by the body itself as a byproduct of its chemical interactions. The rest comes from quote-unquote solid food, which is not that solid after all. A potato contains 80% water. An apple, about 85%. Tomatoes and lettuce, 95%. And a watermelon, 97%. And you wonder, why do they charge so much? Mm-hmm. Even dry bread is 50% water. If you had a hard time comprehending why your doctor told you to drink 8 glasses a day, hopefully now you'll have a better understanding. It is no coincidence, then, that the great civilizations of man, such as Babylon and Egypt, formed around rivers and abundant groundwater. Not only for their commercial value, the rivers enable them to amass wealth by conveying their goods and produce to far-off lands, but simply an adequate water supply was essential for life itself. Thus, the centrality of water is a recurring theme in the Torah, as well as in Tehillim, Psalms, where water in all its aspects is the subject of David HaMelech, of King David's praises. Water is referred to in the Medrash as the source of life. Yeah, on the first page of the source material, you notice there's a Medrash. This is from Avos Rabbi Nosson. The 10 things are called life. You can look at it. The last of it is referring to water. Water is called life. Water is also the basic ingredient of civilization. We read in Tehillim, which is much part of our davening, our prayers. This is Dover Mizmor, this is Lashem or Etzum Loya, Teva Vyeshvevo, Ki Hu Al Yamim Yisoda, Val Nahoris Yechayne Neho. The Psalm of David, the earth is the Lord's and all that fills it, the populated world, and those who dwell in it. For he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. And the Malbim explains, here on the top of page 2, for he's founded it upon the seas. Originally the entire earth was covered with water. And we're going to explain this soon. And God commanded the water be gathered unto the seas. As a result, the dry land was established. Corresponding to the statement, the populated world and those who dwell in it, is the phrase, and he established it upon the rivers. For the final step of the constructing the land to be fit for the populace of man was through the rivers, as they would be able to find water and thereby establish a settled city. And it is through water that Hashem rewards or punishes the Jewish people. Unlike Mesopotamia, the civilization of Babel, Babylon, and Ashur, Assyria, and Egypt, the land of Israel has scarce groundwater supplies and is dependent on rainwater with all of its unpredictability. But as the Torah states, it was intentional. And if you read here on page 2, this is taken from Parshas Ekev. This is Deuteronomy chapter 11. This is from verses 10 to 17. For the land which you enter to possess, referring to Israel, is not as the land of Egypt from where you came out, where you sowed your seed and watered it through your foot as a garden of vegetables. But the land which you are going over to possess is a land of hills and valleys and drinks water from the rain of the skies. A land which the Lord your God cares for, the eyes of the Lord your God are always upon it, from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. And now it continues on. This is now we're beginning the first verses of the second paragraph of Shema. V'hoyim Shemoya Tishmu. And it shall come to pass if you shall give heed diligently to my commandments which I command you this day, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart, with all your soul, that I will give you the rain of your land in its due season, the first rain and the latter rain. You may gather in your grain, in your wine, in your oil. I will send grass in your fields for your cattle, that you may eat and be full. Take heed to yourselves that your heart be not deceived, and you turn not aside and serve other gods and worship them. And then the Lord's anger be kindled against you, and he shall close the skies. There shall be no rain, the land yield not her fruit, unless you perish quickly from off the good land which the Lord gives you. In other words, it was made intentionally that we'd be dependent on water. Just like the rest of creation, especially as relates to Israel and Torah, the entire hydrological cycle and all that is tied up with it was not an afterthought, something added on after the original creation. It was inherent at the very beginning. The earth is initially described as being engulfed and inundated with water. In fact, much of the first 10 verses of the Torah are related to the formation of water and land. And it's worthwhile here on page 3. It's worthwhile to read. The first 10 verses of the Torah. In the beginning, Bereishis Bara Elokim, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, we're going to explain this soon, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, deep referring to water. And the wind, or this is alternately translated as a spirit or air, from God moved upon the face of the waters, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. And we're going to soon explain the relationship of light and water. And God saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning one day. And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, which we're going to explain, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were from under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. There was evening and there was a morning the second day. And God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together to one place. Let the dry land appear, and it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. Evidently, you see that water plays an inordinate role, at least in the beginning of the Torah. Even the original heavens are described in the Medrash, which we're going to quote, at least metaphorically or Kabbalistically, or according to the Malbim, literally, as being partially made up of water. And this is the Medrash that we quote here. This is on page 3. And God called the firmament Shamayim. And the Medrash deals with the origin of the term Shamayim. And there are other explanations besides that of the Medrash. But the Medrash explains, Rav said that Shamayim is derived from two words, Esh and Mayim. And we're going to explain this. Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana said in the name of Rav, so Esh is fire and Mayim is water. The Holy One, blessed be, took fire and water and mixed them together to form Shamayim. Another explanation, the word is written in a way that could also be pronounced as Shomim. For they appraise, the word Shuma is an appraisal, for they appraise the actions of humanity. If they so merit that the heavens relate his righteousness and provide rain. Now the heavens are understood over here not the distant heavens of the planets and the stars, but the heavens referring really to the sky, to the cloud layer. If not, the heavens will reveal his sins by not raining. Another explanation, the word Shomayim is related to the word Shomim. This is like Shomim, Mishnoimim, dumbstruck. For humanity is dumbstruck concerning heaven's nature, for they don't know whether it's made of fire or water. For Pinchas, the name of Rabbi Levi, says, scriptures clarify the matter. It is written in Psalms, he lays the beams of his chambers in the waters, that the basic ingredient of heaven is water. At this point, I'd like to share with you, and better to understand this Medrash, a sampling of the Malbim's commentary to the creation narrative. The Malbim, if you're not familiar, is an acronym of his name, Meir Leibishman Yechiel Mechel. He died in the 1880s. He was one of the greatest of the rabbinic scholars of his time. And he wrote, there were other superb commentaries, but it is ranked as one of the greatest of the biblical commentaries. As you'll see from the citations, the Malbim focus is on the simple and scientific explanation of the text. The treatment, of course, is but one shining facet of the many faceted aspects of the text, which includes, besides the different levels of simple pshat, the literal explanation, also the midrash and kabbalistic explanation. So this doesn't exhaust all that exists here, but it does give us, at least from a scientific viewpoint, it gives us something that we can relate to. Here on page 4, we begin now from quoting from the commentary of the Malbim, from his commentary on the 6th verse of the Torah. This is chapter 1, verse 6. The four elements, he uses this element in a way different than perhaps the ancients understood it. The ancients, and this is a subject of a previous lecture, understood the four elements as we understand now the 92 elements of the periodic table, as they really are that which form all matter. We don't understand it this way, and if you see, the mob himself doesn't understand it that way either. He's referring to the four elements as really the three states of matter, which is the solid, which is the ground, which is the liquid, which is the water, the gas, which is our air. And he explains fire in terms of heat and electromagnetic energy. But these are the four elements that we come across in life. He says, these four elements are constantly mixing with each other, affecting and being affected by each other, particularly air and water. Air is constantly absorbing water. Anything containing moisture that is exposed to the air will have its moisture evaporate into the air and will dry out. This is accomplished in conjunction with the heat and electromagnetic energy that is present in the air and the water. This is clearly evident when, aroused by the rays of the sun, clouds will rise up from the entire surface of the seas and rivers. And the water vapor, when it becomes infused with the elements of the air and the heat, which naturally causes the air and water vapor to expand, will eventually gather together to become thick clouds. As they expand through the heat which is infused in them, they become lighter than air and float upwardly till they reach the upper reaches of the troposphere, where the air is thin and yet the water vapor is still lighter. The troposphere, we're familiar with the term atmosphere. Atmosphere is really a term for a great stretch of open space above the earth. That space which we breathe, which is where the area of the water cycle, which is constantly churning with air and water, is called the troposphere. Tropos comes from a Latin word which means to turn or to churn. Above that is the stratosphere. And the we call the mechitza, that is the separation between the troposphere, where it stops, where clouds no longer rise. They'll rise to a certain point, will not go beyond that point. It's called the tropopause. We'll see from the Malbim, he understands Rakia to be the tropopause. We'll discuss this again in this lecture and in subsequent lecture. So this is what was the making of the Rakia, is really creating this invisible mechitza, this barrier, that beyond that, there is no more troposphere. That's a tropopause. In another lecture, we'll discuss, I believe, the history, how it was discovered. Here, referring to the upper reaches of the troposphere, the vapor turns into clouds and eventually thunderclouds in accordance with the wondrous and mysterious laws of nature that God established, which are still and will always remain beyond the full understanding of humankind. Regarding this process, the Medrash says that Shamayim is derived from the word Eish and Mayim. Again, referring Shamayim here, not referring to the planets and stars, but really to the upper cloud level. This really, we're dealing with the barrier between which separates the troposphere and the stratosphere. This is Eish and Mayim, because this is referring really to the clouds, which have the Eish. He's referring to electromagnetic energy and the heat energy. So, this means carry Mayim. The shin could be, as it's written, could be pronounced as a sin, as the S sound. Saw Mayim, carry water, and Shom Mayim, there is water. And he explains this. Eish and Mayim, again, he's explaining the Medrash. Eish and Mayim is referring to the heat and electromagnetic energy which is hidden in the clouds. Through them, saw, carry Mayim, the water is carried, the water rises to the upper atmosphere, and through them, Shom Mayim, there the water stays at the firmament near the tropopause, where they rise no further and remain there until the heat is released from them. At that point, the clouds thicken and form drops of water that are heavier than air and ultimately fall below to earth. In their descent, they turn into rivers and streams which are formed through direct rainfall and through springs which themselves are formed as a result of rainwater that becomes absorbed in the depths of the earth. And they all flow into the sea, and from there they return through the clouds that rise from the sea up until the cloud cover, and from there they again form streams, and from there the sea. As is stated in Scripture, all the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from where the rivers come, there they return again. Referring, how he understands, referring to the to this water cycle. In his comment, in commentary to the second verse of the Torah, he explains what was the earth like at the time of creation, at least the time that we're focusing on. It was the 6 days of creation. The three elements, and again, he uses elements in a way differently than we would use elements, through which the world was constructed, Ofer, dust of the earth, Mayim, water, and Ruach, air, were mixed together and were not as yet separated, so that the middle element, water, which normally stands in between the element of earth and the element of air, in other words, just simply because there's a ground and there's water, on top of that is air, was mixed with the dust of the earth below and with the air above. Consequently, the earth, which consists of these three elements, was deficient both in its outer appearance, as it consisted of a mixture of water and air, which is called tohu. And as he understood, we didn't have... We have today, in where we live, in the troposphere, is we have, normally, we have this whole area of just pure air. And then we have water below, we have water above in the clouds. At any one time, there's very little precipitation. Originally, though, now the Malbim understands it, it was all one big cloud. There was no air. It was a place that we could breathe. And it went up many, many miles. This is how we understood this. So it was all a mixture. And that's why it says tohu is really had no outer form. And it was also deficient internally, as it consists of a mixture of dust and water, which is called bohu. And it was like quicksand. And it was this whole mixture of just a suspension of these earth particles in the water. So it also went up, you know, there were many miles of this. So really it was not a place for life to start to emerge. Scripture first describes the bohu, that there was darkness on the face of the tahom. Tahom normally translates as deep waters, which means that the lower waters, which are close to the bottom of the sea, which is actually the crust of the earth, was mixed there with the dust of the earth, so it became darkened. Like it was just a thick mass, like a quicksand. In other words, even after the creation of the light, the first light, the light rays cannot penetrate this mixture as would normally penetrate the air and water. For the water, which was intermixed with the earth, was muddy and prevented the rays of light from passing through them. And of course, for life to emerge, you need light. Similarly, the Zohar states that the darkness, the choshech, referred to in this verse, was created by the element of Ofer, the dust of the earth. In regards to tohu, Scripture explains that the Ruach, alternately translated air, or spirit, or wind, of God hovered over the face of the water. So the Malbim understands it in a scientific sense, even could be understood, of course, differently as well, that it doesn't refer to a spirituality, but it means the life-giving air. This is called Ruach Elohim, referring to the air, which is the source of life. For the element of water above was intermixed with the element of air, so that it became like steam or a cloud, which is a mixture of air and water. The element of ruach, air, was hovering over the face of the water, as the Medrash explains. It was hovering like a dove over the nest, touching yet not touching, means barely touching, for the water was in the form of clouds, and air was embedded within it. This is due to the fact that air normally expands, and the water contained therein was touching, but yet not touching. The element of fire is not mentioned. It is evident from this that, as modern scientists have all agreed, that there is no basis for what some of the early scholars believed, that the element of fire is situated above the element of air. The element of fire that we experience is found in the rays of light that travel from the sun, which contain the dual elements of light and heat. But at the time of creation, there existed neither this light nor the heat, which is connected with it. To correct all of these deficiencies that the divine creative statements come, the divine statement, let there be light, came to correct the deficient element of Aish and to illuminate the darkness. The statement, let there be a firmament, came to correct the deficient element of air in its mixture with water. And the statement, on the third day, let the waters gather, came to correct the deficient element of water that was intermixed with the dust of the earth. So, again, we're going to explain this. We're just beginning. But again, how the Malbim has this, the place was a mess, right? And the way to start was to add a little light and heat. Now we're going back now to the Malbim's commentary on the sixth verse. We took from part of it before. We're continuing on here on page six, and he brings different points. And as the fourth point is, scientists agree that the phenomenon that clouds stay in the upper troposphere below the tropopause and from there eventually turn into rain and water is a result of the fact that the rays of the sun, after they first hit the earth, are reflected back and cause the air to warm and eventually rise to the upper troposphere, where they cool. For in the upper reaches of the troposphere, the heat of the reflected light has already dissipated, and the heat contained within the air has already been depleted, and the moisture contained within the air condenses and turns into rain. This is also the view of Avram ibn Ezra, who wrote that the firmament came about as a result of the reflected rays of the sun. The fifth point is, we have already explained that the first statement of creation, the elements emerge in a combined state where the element of mayim, water, was mixed together with the element of ruach, air. As it is written, the ruach of God, of Elohim, was hovering over the face of the water. As a result, the water expanded into the upper atmosphere, for the clouds of mist were full of air, which expanded to a volume many hundreds of times that of simple water until it filled the entire atmosphere. As our sages of blessed memory said, the water rose, the Medrash, unto the divine throne. This means that it rose up until it reached the surface or outside limit of the sphere of domain in outer space of the moon. He is mixing really what was the understood by science of his time in putting it in terms for people who are familiar, which was the science from the ancient time. But it really means really the outside limit of the earth. For the heavens are referred to as the divine throne, as written, says Hashemayim Kisi, says the heaven is my throne. To enable the water to gather so the dry land would be visible, it was first necessary to separate the element of air from the water. In other words, we had to get air in a place that was not mixed with this water vapor. So the water would be purified and its volume be diminished, as will be explained further on. For this reason, prior to making the statement, let the waters gather, it was necessary to first complete the firmament. And this is the tropopause. For the function of the firmament, even to this day, is to convert the clouds, which are made up of water, mixed with air, into pure water. Similarly, on the second day, when the firmament was made, its function was to distill the air, which was hovering within the element of water, and convert the mist into pure water. Basically, it was to get this process started. It was to jumpstart the process. So really, it came out that all of the clouds, through this thing, really started to lift it up. And they all came to a certain point, which was the tropopause, because of the light. This was in preparation for the gathering of the waters. It was further explained. I mean, the gathering of the waters was to create dry land for which mankind could develop. Well, there has to be a land. There has to be air. However, in order to create this firmament, it was necessary to first preface it with the statement, let there be light. Just as this firmament, even now, is sustained through the light of the sun, which hits the surface of the earth and is reflected back till the upper troposphere, as we previously stated in the fourth point. Similarly, he formulated the nature of the light that was created on the first day to act in like manner. Its intensity, however, was much stronger, for the light burned like fire and accomplished through the command of God in one day what would normally take regular sunlight many years to accomplish. So it was jump-started, so to speak. Now the Malbim is going to explain further about the firmament But we'll touch upon a medrash about the firmament, as we're going to see how the Malbim explains. And again, on the medrash dealing with God said, let there be a firmament or a kiyah in the midst of the water. The rabbi said in the name of Chanina, Rav Pinchas, and Rav Yaakov, Rav Oven said in the name of Rav Shmuel, Rav Nachman. At the time the Holy One, blessed be He, said, let there be a firmament, rakia, in the midst of the water. The drop of water vapor at the midpoint formed a thin membrane. And through that were formed the lower heavens and the upper heavens. In other words, rakia is a very thin membrane. And it's really composed, I mean, according to this medrash, related at least to water vapor. Rav said that they were moist on the first day, on the second day they hardened. The expression, let there be firmament, actually means let the firmament harden. Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Simon said, this verse is to be understood, let there be a thin plate. Now, the rakia is just as the word rakia is used in the verse, and they beat, this is, raku, the gold, into thin plates. Basically, it's a thin plate was created. And again, according to the Malbim, this is referring again to the tropopause. Rabbi Chanina said, fire came from above and licked the face of the firmament. It came through heat. Now, how was this formed? It was formed through heat. When Rabbi came to the verse, you know, by his winds, he has made the heaven fair, he would say, Rabbi Chanina taught me well. Through his spirit, but was really through this heat. Rabbi Shimon said, a fire came from above, came and singed the face of the firmament. So the Malbim explains this here on page 8. And God made the firmament, Vayas Elokim Esarikiyah. The term Asiya, Vayas, making, always refers to the completion. For the process of making the firmament, means, again, the tropopause, was not perfectly finished, as the higher waters, which were above the firmament, were similar in their nature to the waters below. Afterwards, the firmament was completed. This is what Rabbi Chanina meant by saying, fire came from above and licked the face of the firmament. Through the fire means heat and electromagnetic energy that was inherent in the light that was created on the first day. The element of fire and electromagnetism dominated the upper atmosphere through the command of God, became intermixed with the higher clouds. He understood that originally there was, just as we know what's here below, and there's clouds and there's vapor, he understood that half of this water vapor, at least how the Malbim understood, arose above the cloud layer. And it was spread out, again, many miles, perhaps in a different form than it originally was. The Malbim himself, in his, as we're going to see in his narrative, his explanation of the flood, maintained that all this water eventually fell down at the time of the Mabul. We have very little of it left. And he explained that Rubas HaShamayim, the windows of heaven that were opened up, is referring to bring that water down. But he continued on, through this the air and the upper waters became purified, for they both returned to their basic states and became thin air. They also thinned out, so to speak, above the, and there was air, at least space, that was no water vapor. Water vapor. Air that is not fit to breathe because it's so thin, and water that is only water in a potential sense, and only turns into rain through God's desire to pour forth His providential rain of blessing. He maintained as well, and we're going to discuss this soon, that there's a role for this upper, this higher vapor. It's not only in terms, as we're going to see in the future lecture, about the flood. He maintains that there is a, besides the water that comes from the normative cycle, which is predictable in a certain sense. I mean, it's not really predictable, but and as a person knows the heat and knows the conditions on Earth, there's a certain prediction you can make. But there is a, how the Malbim understands, based on Rabbeinu's Bachir, that this water vapor, clandestinely, Hashem feeds into the clouds as well, so that He could direct this water vapor to create clouds where under the normal circumstances they wouldn't be there, or to enrich the clouds, feeding them more water vapor. And this is the water that comes through a special hashgacha, through special providential rain, when we are worthy of this. That is right. That is water vapor, which is above the troposphere, the tropopause, which is not really readily visible, but God marshals it and puts it in certain areas when it's necessary. And this, he makes a distinction, at least how the Malbim, and according to the Malbim's definition of the terms, not necessarily everyone's, between Geshem, which is the normal water cycle, and Motar, which he learns as this providential rain, whose source is really this Mayim El Yoinim from the water which comes above the cloud layer. Now, the further on here in the Malbim, this is the last citation from his commentary that we're going to have. This is now on the eighth verse. The seventh is the eighth verse. The firmament, the tropopause, now became part of the boundary of the heaven, as it was no longer considered to be part of the earth's boundary. For life could no longer be sustained there. In other words, he called this heaven. Why was this called heaven? I mean, there's earth and heaven. Earth is where the activity of mankind is, or life. And that reaches up until the cloud layer. Beyond that, like, it's really hard to climb up Mount Everest. I don't know if you should try, but please take a Sherpa guide, please. But it's very hard to climb up the Mount Everest. There's very little air. That area above the cloud layer was called Shemayim. It's beginning here. The heavens and the area which is not part of the earth was the boundary was clearly defined then. And that's what he says. It's no longer part of the earth's boundary, for life could no longer be sustained there. The phrase, and he called, by Yikro, he called, means that at that time he placed within it the firmament, and this is a tropopause, the distinct nature that it was to be part of heaven, it would no longer be fit for the denizens of the earth, as I will explain this further on the verse. Then God called the dry land earth. The reason does not say, and God saw that it was good, is because this was only a preparation for the statement made on the third day, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together to one place. For it would not have been possible to gather the waters without first finishing the firmament. Since this work wasn't entirely finished until the third day, he wasn't able to say that it was good, for its goodness was not yet evident. That which is above the firmament is the Shemei Shemayim, which is the higher waters which are above the firmament, which constitute the lower heavens. Now, this is not a heaven which we mean the planets or stars, but it's, in a sense, not part of Earth. And then, now, referring now to the events, these are the events of creating the water cycle, so to speak. And now, referring to dry land, and the verse says, this is in the first chapter, it says, and God said, says, let the waters under the heaven be gathered to one place. This is the ninth and tenth verse. And let the dry land appear, and it was so. And God called the dry land earth. The gathering together of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. And the Malbim explains, let the dry land appear. This additional command was for the purpose of separating the water from the dust of the earth. No longer would be a suspension. It would only be like, it would be quicksand. It would be a clear water separated from earth. For we've already stated the meaning of the phrase, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. It is the element of Mayim, water, which was below on the earth, was mixed with the element of Ophir, the dust of the earth. After it repaired the Tohu, which is the outer surface, and it separated the element of Ruach, air, from the element of water, He commanded the element of water should become separate from the element of Ophir, the dust of the earth. The dry land would become visible. For there is a distinction between the term Yabosha, dry land, and the term Charova, which also means dry land. Land that is still moist is referred to as Charova. command, however, that the element of mayim and moish be separated out of the offer, the dust of the earth to become yabosh, a dry land. With this, he repaired the bohu, and now life was fit. The earth was fit for life. It is important to note that even though much of the underground water was removed to form the seas, there still exists vast underground reservoirs of water right below the surface of the soil, as well as that which are resting beneath bedrock, which serves as the source for the artesian wells, which irrigate our crops and provide more water for our consumption. Under normal circumstances, when it rains, the groundwater in the aquifers are replenished, often by rain that falls many miles away that eventually seeps down through what is known as a recharge area into the aquifer. So it falls, but it goes down, it's absorbed, and finally makes its way to perhaps miles away, and it falls basically into a storage area. This is perhaps the explanation of the following Gemara in Tainus in 25b. Here is on the bottom, page 9. It was taught, Rav Shimon Elazar says, not a handbreadth of rain, a tefach of rain, comes down from above without the deep, with three handbreadths coming up from below to meet it. Now this water rains here, but because of the periphery that it's absorbed, finally comes up and rises above. So in terms of providing water and for the crops, so we have the water which directly goes below, let's say at one point here. But the water that falls a few miles below very often seeps down and makes its way through. So now it says we have this aquifer that is now being pushed by this water and now pushes its way up. In addition, many scientists are convinced that below the crust of the earth lies a wealth of water, perhaps enough to fill perhaps 30 oceans, but that's below the crust. This too may eventually prove to be an additional source of needed water, and the scientists are wondering how could they possibly tap this. This is when a volcano erupts, I think like 70% of what comes out is water vapor. There's an awful lot of water vapor below. Up until now, we've explained the importance as well as the historical development. Through Maisa Bracious, of our water system. One point that we haven't fully touched upon is the fact, as we mentioned earlier, that the oceans contain an enormous amount of water, over 97% of the total. Like 97.2%. Why all that water? You know, it's like the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. You know, water, water everywhere. But as we pointed out, the evaporation from the oceans is a source of much of our rainfall. If we didn't have the oceans as the source, we wouldn't have this rainfall. Eventually, it gets back, you know, the oceans are not depleted. Without it, virtually no rain would fall. It's estimated that approximately 389,000 cubic kilometers of water goes into the air annually as water vapor. Of this amount, 328,000 cubic kilometers, a little less than 85%, are evaporated from the world's oceans. Some 291,000 cubic kilometers of the evaporated water falls back to the seas. But the rest, some 98,000 cubic kilometers, fall back to Earth. 37,000 cubic kilometers fall on land and feed rivers and springs, and the remaining 61,000 infiltrate into the soil, available for absorption by plants and replenishment of ground reservoirs. And we see here on page 10, also a Gemara Tainus, this is from Kesavim Basin, 90. It has been taught, Rav Eliezer said, the whole world draws its water supply from the waters of the ocean. which as we understood, this is the cycle referring to. As it said, there went up a mist from the earth and watered the whole of the ground. Thereupon Rabbi Yeshua said to him, but are not the waters of the ocean salty? And he replied, they're sweetened by the clouds, which is understood as the process really of the evaporation and condensation really just rids itself of the salt. Rabbi Yeshua said, the whole world drinks from the upper waters. Basically, this is the mutter. And it drinks and brings and drinketh water as the rain of the heavens comes down. And it seems that the Malbim learns that they are both true. That the normative cycle is this water cycle that comes from the oceans. But there is this providential rain that comes down from above the cloud layer. Now, as we said, at least it would seem after the flood, this has been severely depleted. However, there are other sources which seem to replenish this depletion of the water vapor. Scientists theorize that outside of our solar system lies what is known as the Oort cloud. This is the astronomer Hendrik Oort. And it contains, according to scientific speculation, a million comets, largely made up of ice. In addition, there's evidence that the Earth is constantly being bombarded by ice from outer space, making its way down into Earth. This was discovered by Dr. Louis A. Frank of the University of Iowa. According to a news article in the Washington Post on May 29, 1997, each day, thousands of 20 to 40 ton, quote unquote, snowballs, the size of a two-bedroom home, streak into the atmosphere some 600 to 15,000 miles up and deposit large clouds of water vapor that should fall down on the Earth's surface as rain. And perhaps, I mean, at least according to this news report, that's the source of this mutter, this providential rain. Not necessarily the original vapor canopy, but it's constantly being replenished. But sometimes more than a mere snowball makes its way to Earth. The Cambridge Atlas of Astronomy, on page 219 of the 1985 edition, reported the following. In the morning of the 30th of June, 1908, a fantastic explosion occurred in central Siberia. Witnesses described an enormous meteoric bolide, or fireball, visible in the sky for a few seconds. Other witnesses at a distance of 60 kilometers from the point of impact were knocked over. Seismic shocks were registered over the whole world. The explanation now accepted is that this event was due to the collision of a block of ice weighing 30,000 tons, which released energy equivalent to that of a thermonuclear bomb of 12 megatons. That's 12 million tons of TNT. For comparison, the bomb dropped over Hiroshima was only the equivalent of a little over 20,000 tons of TNT. So this was like, this would be equivalent of 500 of the bombs that went over Hiroshima. It's now understood that this ice block, as we theorized, was a very small piece of the nucleus of the comet Encke, whose origin is speculated from these Oort clouds, which we mentioned. So there's an awful lot of water up there. Up until now, we've discussed what water does. It provides the matrix for life on this planet. What exactly is water? The name itself, water, seems to connote a sense of mystery. Just like the name mana, actually means, according to some opinions, means what? You know, refer here on page 10, we quote one of the opinions of the Mechilta when they ask, what is this? It says, mon hu means what is this? according to one opinion. Similarly, the name Mayim is coincidentally similar to the word my in Hebrew Aramaic, which means what? The same as in other languages. Water is very similar to the word what? Just as Wasser in Yiddish and German is similar to the word Voss. Even in Latin we see this familiarity. The word for what in Latin is qua. The word for water is aqua. In other words, being principally a liquid, water is formless, taking the form of its container. So it has no specific form. Basically, calling it Maya means calling it liquid. According to the Maharal, formlessness is actually its symbolic essence. And water, mayim, represents at once formlessness as well as the potential to receive a form. It is actually water's liquid form that enables life to flourish. The constant movement of the cell, composed largely of water, transporting thousands of materials within it and without. The constant flow of blood with its relative low viscosity, thickness, could only be accomplished with water as its base. But perhaps there are other reasons that water is such a mysterious substance. First of all, with rare exceptions, liquids are more dense at lower temperatures than at higher, and are more dense as a solid than as a liquid. Water, however, is quite unique. Up until 4 degrees Celsius, which is 39 degrees Fahrenheit, water becomes more dense as it cools. But at 4 degrees Celsius, something unusual occurs. The water begins to expand. And at freezing, 0 degrees Celsius, 32 degrees Fahrenheit, it expands even further by as much as 11%. If this were not so, much of the water on Earth would probably lie frozen at the bottom of the oceans, as the water in its frozen state would sink to the bottom, freezing from the bottom up, until the entire sea with all the living creatures therein would be one frozen mass. But due to water's unique qualities, even that part of the southern sea close to Antarctica is only covered with a relatively thin covering of ice. As the newly formed ice floats on the surface, and the most dense water, at 4 degrees Celsius, still warm enough to support life, is at the bottom. There are fish there. Another very unusual feature of water is that although as a liquid, water has four times the thermal conductivity of any other common liquid, which is enhanced by its ability as a liquid to form convection currents, you know, they go up and down, to distribute heat energy. In its solid state as ice, however, is a relatively poor conductor of heat or cold. Therefore, ice at the top of a lake in the winter works as an insulator for the rest of the water at the bottom, especially when, in addition, the ice is covered with snow. With snow, really, there's a lot of air in between, protecting it from the freezing air temperatures above the ice and hindering the process of freezing the water below, as it comes in the water which comes in contact with the ice. It would seem that Eskimos make use of the insulating property of ice in building their igloos. Another most unusual property of water is also related to its thermal qualities. Most substances with a molecular weight similar to that of water are gases at ambient, which are normal temperatures. If water were to follow this general rule, it would freeze at minus 100 degrees Celsius and boil at minus 80 degrees. Now, there are many gases which are very similar to water which have this. But of course, for a reason we'll soon discuss, water freezes at 0 degrees Celsius. Will remain largely liquid up until 100 degrees Celsius, within a range that's conducive for life on this planet. In addition, the thermal capacity, or what is known as specific heat of water, the amount of heat needed to raise the temperature of water 1 degree Celsius centigrade, is higher than most liquids. Water has the capacity to absorb large amounts of heat without even noticeably raising its temperature. It is this ability that enables the warm ocean currents, such as the Gulf Stream, to carry within it phenomenal amounts of heat energy. The Gulf Stream, by the way, which carries heat from the tropics of South America north, northeastward across the Atlantic, keeps northern Europe much warmer than, for instance, Labrador, which is the same latitude. It's estimated the Gulf Stream bears with it twice as much heat as would be produced by burning the amount of coal which is mined throughout the world in a whole year. Also, another interesting feature of water is that for most substances, the amount of heat needed to increase their temperature by 1 degree is the same with each degree involved. With water, however, between 35 and 40 degrees Celsius, which is between 95 and 104 degrees Fahrenheit, it's relatively easy to raise its temperature. Coincidentally, that narrow range represents the body temperatures of most active animals, enables them to more easily maintain their ideal body temperature. Furthermore, when ice melts or evaporates, heat is absorbed from the environment. The opposite happens when water liquefies or freezes. Heat is released. This phenomenon is known as latent heat. The latent heat of freezing of water is one of the highest of all known liquids. In the ambient or normal temperature range, only ammonium is higher. Because of this, when water freezes, it releases an enormous amount of heat, which in turn warms the surrounding water and air to modify and ameliorate the bitter cold. So when it freezes, it becomes warm, in a sense. Similarly, in the air, when the temperature drops and the water vapor begins to turn into rain or ice, the heat released counteracts the effect of the cold. Moderating, this is the weather maintaining some modicum of warmth, even in the winter. Because when it's vapor and it forms into a liquid, so therefore it releases its energy. It becomes very hot. So you have similarly, water's latent heat of evaporation is the highest of any fluid. And it's to become it's a vapor and becomes a liquid. Now, when it becomes a liquid and becomes a vapor, so it has to get an awful lot of energy to make it into a vapor. So it absorbs an awful lot of energy. It is because of this unique ability, the body is able to regulate its temperature when it is heated through sweating. When you sweat, by sweat, it really turns into vapor. You know, when you sweat, you know, things, it really turns into vapor. And turning into vapor, it really has to take off a lot of heat from the body. So as we sweat, we are being cooled because it draws this heat. It pulls for the heat from the body, therefore lowering the body's temperature. That's how, in the old days, what did they do when the kid had a fever? Gave him plenty of water, and it sweat. Those old enough in the room, you know, this is before Tylenol. This is how the temperature was lowered. The same way in the summer, as water evaporates from the rivers and lakes, it draws heat from the air and thereby moderating the effects of summer. Without these special thermal qualities, life as we know would probably not be possible. But its thermal properties are not the only thing that makes water so unique and so indispensable for life. If there's anything that comes close to the fable Alkahest of the alchemists, the mythical universal solvent, it is water. No other liquid approaches water its ability to dissolve and interact with other substances. Nearly all known chemicals dissolve and interact with water to a slight but to detectable extent. Seconds after distilled water is caught in a beaker, is contaminated by molecules of glass. The water that runs over rocks dislodges and dissolves its minerals, making them available to be absorbed by plant and animal life. At least 33 different elements can be found in the sea, and probably many, many more present in trace amounts. human urine contains many hundreds of different compounds, and they're all dissolved in water. But despite its power to interact, by and large, water remains quite inert. It's not appreciably changed in the process, but goes on working round and round again and again, enabling plants and animals to ingest the minerals of the earth, transform them into the materials of their cells. Without exhausting water's highly unusual qualities, and basically, it's an amazing coincidence from the Torah's viewpoint, this is how it was specifically designed. I would like to find dwell upon two unique but related aspects of water that make it indispensable for life. The first is surface tension. Except for mercury or liquid selenium, no other liquid sticks together and forms such a strong film on its surface like water. A film of water, just one molecule thick, readily supports the weight of a host of insects which stride and skate on its surface. And it can even keep a needle or a flat metal plate afloat. In other words, water molecules naturally cling together and form a membrane. The second but related aspect is known as capillarity or capillary action. Water grabs at everything. This is clinging to molecules of other substances and once attached, hauls itself upstream, so to speak, moving against the tide, holding tight even to the smooth walls of veins and arteries, and pulling its fellow water molecules with it. Water in a tube, 1 millimeter across, rises about a foot, with a diameter 1/10 smaller, will rise 10 feet. Without this property, it seems that circulation of the capillaries and ultimately life would cease. Because how do we get the water? Basically, we're made of capillaries. They're the things that push the blood and get them into the cell. For this reason, too, when one water molecule finds its way into the narrow cracks and fissures in the rocks, it pulls many others with it, washing chemicals from rocks. Later in the winter, when the water freezes and expands, the rocks become fragmented, which assists the weathering process and the formation of soil. It is also this high surface tension of water which draws water through the soil within reach of the roots of the plants and assists its rise from the roots to the branches of even tall trees. From all that I've said, it's clear the water was uniquely created for the purpose of providing the matrix and support of life. But what is water's secret? As we've mentioned many features of water. But how is water, what's so unique about the water molecule that it can do all of this? In previous lectures, we've spoken about the Kabbalah and its numbering system. There are 10 spheros, Kabbalistic forces, which correspond to the basic decimal system, as well as the list of tens which are enumerated at the beginning of the fifth parak chapter above us. For instance, the world was created by 10 statements, 10 generations from Adam to Noah, another 10 generations of Noah to Avram. Avram, Abraham was given 10 tests, etc. According to the Maharal, the number 10 symbolizes the concept of multiplicity that combines into a united whole. Because it becomes... since we're on a decimal system, it becomes now the first one of the next place. It also symbolizes the Shekhinah, the divine presence. The spiritual world was created with the letter Yud, whose numeric value is 10. According to the Greek system, which was developed by Empedocles and embraced by Aristotle, water is a basic element. As Amal pointed out, which we quoted at the top of page 11, here, it says on the top of page 11, it has been discovered that the basic element of fire is also hidden, as we've discussed this before, within the basic elements of air, as is well known from electrical experiments. This energy is also contained within the basic elements of water, which is a compound of two elementary gases, which is, of course, oxygen and hydrogen. One This is the symbol for water, of course, is H2O, which is one atom of oxygen and two atoms of hydrogen. Heat these two gases together, and you'll produce water. Run an electric current through water, you'll produce oxygen and hydrogen. The atomic number of oxygen is 8. Not its weight, but its number. Oxygen is 8 protons and 8 electrons. The atomic number of hydrogen is 1. The total number of protons in a water molecule then is 10. 8 of oxygen and 2 of hydrogen, H2O. No wonder then that water is the basis for life. It really, this is the molecule that contains 10 electrons or 10 protons. But water's secret lies in yet another amazing feature. When most elements combine to form a molecule, they adopt a regular geometry, building up at angles of 45, 60, or 90 degrees. That makes it possible for them to be neatly arranged and equally spaced. When hydrogen combines with oxygen, however, the two hydrogen atoms always come to rest at an angle of 104.5 degrees, making it look, at least in diagrams, like ears attached to the head of a panda. It looks like Mickey Mouse. In other words, water in comparison to other molecules is lopsided. But that's not all. Today, based upon the research of Linus Pauling, who received a Nobel Prize for his work in 1954, his work was done in 1939, scientists understand that at the other end, opposite to the hydrogen atoms, the panda ears, the two pairs of electrons stick out as far from each other, as far from the hydrogen atoms as they can get. So really the structure of a water molecule is a tetrahedron with four corners, two hydrogen ions or protons without electrons, one in each corner. As hydrogen's electrons were taken over by oxygen. In other words, they pull, in other words, oxygen is very clepidic. You know, it takes the electron of the hydrogen in that sense, and therefore the proton just moves away. So on the two sides, you got a proton here and a proton there of the this is the hydrogen ion, which is now at 104.5 degrees apart from each other. But at the other end, there's a two pairs of electrons that also stick out on the opposite corners. So if you pretend you're a water molecule, you want another life, you know, want to change. You stick out your hands at 104.5 oblique angle to represent the hydrogen ions. They go like this. And your two legs space far apart, ideally 109 degrees, to represent the two pairs of electrons. Your head and trunk would be the oxygen atom. Now your hands, which represent the hydrogen ions, are positive and are attracted to the negative charge of electrons. So if you see someone else passing by, your hand reaches out, not to his hands, similar electric charges repel each other, but to his ankles, right? The negative charge of the pair of electrons. And you clasp his ankle and hold on. In theory, you can attach yourself to four other people this way. Your two hands hold on to two people's ankles. Your ankles are held by two people's hands. It looks like an acrobatic group, right? Now, in theory, you can do this by lying on the ground. Or if you and your friends are acrobats, you can do this, you know, as a group of five. That's the basic formation of a water molecule. Since it's a liquid, it keeps on changing hands, you know, it keeps on. And those five attach themselves onto another five ad infinitum. That is the secret of surface tension and capillary action, is the attraction of the various positive and negative charges. The term for all of this is called hydrogen bonding. And that is the secret of the powerful solvent qualities of water. As long as the other substance has some charge, water will grab hold of its figurative hand or ankle. For that reason, water does not mix with oil. Lipids, such as fats or oil, are not polar, with negative and positive poles, and therefore are not attracted to water. On the contrary, water clings to itself away from the lipids. That's why waxed paper never gets wet, because wax is composed of nonpolar molecules. That is also the reason that the boiling point of water is so high, 100 degrees Celsius, instead of the expected minus 80 degrees for something with a similar atomic weight. Because the electric polar bonds are so strong, it takes all that energy to break them apart. Boiling means that it's broken apart. It doesn't want to break apart. And that's why it's so hard to raise the temperature of water even 1 degree. It's difficult for the heat energy to overcome the electromagnetic bonds between the water molecules. Heat is movement. The reason the water expands also based upon this principle. Although we explain that due to hydrogen bonding, the molecular structure of water is that of a group of 5 molecules, as water freezes and loses its energy, these groups of 5 cluster together to form a crystal lattice structure of 6 sides, a hexagon. Water as a liquid is constantly in motion, making and breaking these relatively weak hydrogen bonds. But as it freezes and loses heat energy, the hydrogen bonds dominate, and the 5 molecule groups of water naturally form into 6-sided crystals. This creates a rather open network with lots of space in between. That's why it's 11% more as it expands. That's why ice expands. There's more space. The last page contains examples of snowflakes, which are ice crystals. They illustrate the varieties of the hexagon shape. You can look at it. As you're well aware, the number 4, which represents the Shem HaMefarish, the tetragrammaton, Hashem's holy name, corresponds with the tetrahedron of water. With this, we can have a deeper understanding of the Medrash, which is on the last page here, that water is a metaphor for Hashem himself. As we explained, due to the hydrogen bonding, water clusters together in a group of 5. And it freezes, crystallizes onto a hexagon, arranging the cluster of the 5 into a group of 6. The last 2 letters of tetragrammaton are a Vav, which is 6, and a He, which is 5. In other words, water forms into a 4-faceted molecule, a tetrahedron, with the atomic number of water being 10, the first letter of Hashem's name. It clusters into groups of 5, the second and fourth letter of his name, and crystallizes into 6 sides, the third letter of his name. In addition, we find that the Torah itself is compared to water, as we said in the last citation on page 11. On a molecular level, there's also another comparison, besides the many symbolic comparisons. The Torah Shebiktav, the written Torah, is divided into 5 parts. It's the 5 chumashim. The oral Torah into 6 sedorim, orders. 10 commandments, 5 chumashim, 6 sedorim, the orders. Time doesn't allow to go through the various sources, but based on what we know about physical water, and the principle that there's a correspondence between the physical world and the spiritual world, it is no wonder then that water was used extensively in the Novi, the Prophets, Gemara, Medrash, Zohar, and related literature as the model and metaphor for Torah and spirituality. As the Medrash says, there ain mayim el Torah. So the Gemara, water is a metaphor for Torah. Ein mayim el HaKadosh Baruch Hu, water is a metaphor for Hashem himself. Now, I'd like to quickly go over the questions that are in the beginning. See if you can answer these questions. How much water does the world contain? And we explained this 326 cubic miles, which would be a cube. Each side is 688 miles. What percent is in the oceans? It's 97.2%. According to the Malbim, what are the definitions of the term tohu and vohu? So tohu is the outer formlessness, which is a combination of the water, this water vapor and air. And bohu is the inner formlessness, which was the combination of this mud and water, this quicksand. explain how the light that was created on the first day transformed the face of the earth and made life possible. And this is because the heat generated, according to the Malbim, really created the separation and created the whole, this whole atmosphere, the troposphere and the tropopause. Describe five unusual properties of water. Well, one is it expands at a low, at lower temperature, which is unusual. It's a, at, as a solid, it's a poor conductor of heat, which therefore uses it, it insulates the water below and prevents its freezing. Water is a liquid at ambient temperatures. In other words, an equivalent compound to that atomic weight. Its area of liquidity would be between 180 minus Celsius. And yet here, it's really at a much higher level, which enables life to function. We also said that it's relatively easy to raise temperatures between 35 and 40 degrees centigrade. This is different than because it enables life to exist. It has the quality of specific heat. As it takes an awful lot of heat to raise it 1 degree, it holds a lot of heat without changing and boiling. And that enables the Gulf Stream. It has this latent heat. There's a heat which it absorbs or releases. And also it warms the earth, makes us cool. It's a universal solvent. It has the quality of surface tension. It has this sort of capillarity. And finally, what is the source of water's uniqueness? We explained it's really the uniqueness of the water molecule, which is the two ions of hydrogen separate 104.5 degrees, and it creates the polarity on the other side of two, which really enables it to attach itself to everything. And now, are there any questions?
As far as also one other thing, if you're saying that we're constantly bombarded with additional waters, what after a period of time, in other words, everything should go up no matter what? What happens to that additional water? That's what's causing things to rise? Because you're getting additional waters from outer space and every place else.
So, we should be getting additional.
The bottle is filling up.
Yeah. So, what is?
Where's it going?
Well, there's a. This is not the thing, but part of, at least this is the theory, that the oceans themselves, the crust of the earth contain below the crust of the earth, and the mantle contains an awful lot of water. That water is really absorbed is through the movement of the plates. There's at least they theorize that there's water being absorbed. So it could be that that's where this water is going.
And the Malvin, he's in the 1880s.
Right.
Is he, because of modern science, what is there anything he brings down to Mars or whatever, but was there this common understanding prior to that?
Probably before we had very poor understanding of what was doing in the skies until the late 1700s and through the 1800s. Before that, probably he couldn't have said what he said. He wouldn't have had any of the understanding. So really, it's really because of what came to light that he was able to explain it in this way.
Statement and a question. The first statement is, I just saw a program where they're isolating water for energy as they use windmills for energy now.
Yeah.
They've isolated, they put units in the ocean, which create tremendous amounts of energy, equivalent to an entire city, I believe was near the Boston area where they're first doing this.
Yeah, but they're doing it through the ocean currents, I think.
There's
the
currents
are
right.
Yeah, there was an interest. There was
energy,
right. There's a tremendous amount of energy in the ocean currents itself. Even though it really makes a lot of sense, unit energy of the ocean currents to create, really, instead of using, you know, basically instead of using, you know, what would be like Lake Mead, you know, Hoover Dam, you know, using water that comes through a dam to churn the generator and to make electricity, you could use the water currents themselves. It doesn't cost anything. I mean, except the construction of the thing. But it's not, it's a reusable source of energy. It makes an awful lot of sense.
And the question I had was about the troposphere considered heavens.
Yeah,
so
right.
When astronauts go up, are they truly in heaven? Because when you fly high altitudes, are you close to heaven? I mean,
well, it depends, it gets what you define as heaven. You know, some one person, I don't want to say the name, but I just have to tell you this. I mean, it's a great, that somebody was speaking at a Sheva Brachas, and it was saying that, you know, his wife is a tzaddikus. She's going to go to heaven. He, on the other hand, who knows where he's going to go. But he understands that, you know, they wouldn't be separated. So what do? So he says, my wife loves shopping. For her, that's heaven, Gan Eden. For me, that's Gehenna. What they're going to do is, for all eternity, she and I are going to go shopping. One person's heaven is another person's. Yeah, okay.
Isn't it kind of ironic to say that with all this water, we have a water crisis in the world, unusable. You talk about all this water, it's nice, but most of it we can't drink, touch, or tap.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, this is, it's a major, water is a major, major problem. It's a problem for us. As we were saying about the problem, you know, it touches, as we said, this energy thing. It would be a wonderful thing if we didn't have to come on to the oil from the, you know, from the OPEC nations. On the other hand, you know, in theory, there's a possibility for us to create our own source of this bioenergy. But a tremendous cost. They were thinking about they would have to bring in water. Basically, there's a major problem that in this Corn Belt, in the states where they're doing, there's really not enough for all that's happening. There's not enough water, and they have to draw from the aquifers, and it's being depleted. So really, there really isn't enough. There is really a problem. Yeah, we were made to function on land. Because basically is we need fire to function. Fire creates metals, right? We just couldn't be, you know, we really have to be on land. That's why the first bracha we begin in the beginning is Borei Maror Ha'Esh. And we start with fire. Wood is really, it feeds, you know, it's when they speak of the basic thing, I mean, they are, it's a derivative of the others. You know, that's how they look at it. Again, I don't want to speak about elements, how the ancients understood this, but basically is that you have the solid of the solid elements, and you have the liquid water, and you have the air, and it's a derivative. Okay, but we'll speak more about wood in the next lecture. Okay, yeah, sure. Okay, good to vach, and Mr. Shem, I'll see you next week.